Hello, Sean. This is Anshuman Sinha. Thank you for showing up on my podcast, Startup
My
Pulse.
Pleasure.
Dear audience, today we have a great guy, Sean Sanders. He lives in Orange County. He is a law professor at USC. He runs his own company called VentureCraft, and he is all about storytelling in your pitching. He is all about building the ecosystem right here in Orange County and beyond. He's a great guy. So today we'll be exploring. He has a standard line, be understood and get funded. So we will be exploring that a lot. So with that, Sean, please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Yeah. So first off, thanks for having me. And looking forward to answer any questions you have and anything that might come from, I don't know, anybody listening in. If you have questions, feel free to reach out because I like to work with the community and build stuff. Me in a nutshell, man, I've been working in the startup world for like 20 years. So I had a couple of my own startups in the tech world. I had like a Geek Squad variant where we did tech support and things like that. And I did that for a while before I got into consulting, then primarily consulted with some local companies, and then also companies up north, Y Combinator. So I worked with Reddit and Hipmunk and Airbnb and De Niro when it came to marketing, branding, user aggregation, even like infographics. My background started off in search engine optimization and graphic design. And so did that for a while before I found myself always kind of bumping up to a ceiling of wanting to be more involved in deal flow. So kind of worked my way up in consulting to get more into operations. Then became an attorney and was corporate counsel of a small investment fund for a few years. That was fun. I love being an attorney because I feel like it gives you an edge, where attorneys are the only people who read the rules to the board game that we're all playing, whether we like it or not. But it just wasn't quite a fit for me. I like risk. I like building things. I like risk. I like diving in without, I like building the airplane while in flight. And that didn't quite always work when I was in my attorney role. I found myself commonly being like, hey, as an attorney, I recommend you, you do this. But, as a business guy, go ahead and roll some dice on this. So step back from that role and then launched out VentureCraft. And these days, I serve as the senior associate director of Octane Launchpad, which is one of the highest rated SBDC funded accelerators in the country. And then yes, VentureCraft is split between basically two clientele. Half of my clients are in the angel VC world, so working with startups and early stage technologies to build their investor presentations, their stories, their the thing that we say is the most important asset they'll ever own, which is a story that people care about. And then on the other side, I work with NASA, NOAA, NIH, DOD, the whole alphabet soup of government agencies through the CBER program. So phase 1, phase 2. And there's the same process. I'm working with early stage technologies, brilliant engineers who have great technology, but they struggle when it comes to articulating it to anybody other than themselves. So I like to tell my clients that at the end of working with myself and my team, you'll be able to explain to your parents what you do for a living, which I think is the ultimate goal. So that's me in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for that introduction. Octane, the work that you are doing with them, great work. And, your relationship with the SBIR and STTR, all those things are great. But, let's focus on the startup that you have. Yep. So those startups are what? Early stage startup, angel funded, in MVP stage, or somebody who has just an idea? Who do you have?
Usually it's going to be seed to series A. So I don't get, I generally don't get too involved in the ideation phase. Now I say that with an asterisk because I do a lot of, pro bono work in the community with like high schools or colleges. And so I work with a lot of students who are at the ideation stage, but I don't consider those clientele as much as that's just me trying to help nurture the ecosystem. My actual clients generally at that point, they at least have an MVP, a minimum viable product. They understand who their market is. They have the core sort of functions of what you would think of when you think of a startup. They just need help, again, raising the capital, which means they have to communicate their passion to an external audience in a way that they care. And that's where we come in.
So they should be in touch with you before they go into the fundraising round.
100%.
Or they have raised some friends and family round, but now they are going seriously into the fundraising in front of angel groups or micro VC firms. That is the time when you should come into the play, and you will help them in basically from their pitch deck all the way, how to pitch, what to say, what not
100%.
to say, and how to get funded.
100%. Because what we do, we specialize in de-risking. So when you find yourself about to have an opportunity where you have a room full of wealthy people that are going to consider opening their wallets and giving you cash, without a service like myself, you go in, you do your best, maybe you hear back, maybe you don't. But we're kind of that dojo that helps you prepare and train and get that feedback loop, so you know what worked, what didn't work, and everybody needs it. I mean, myself, I have an ed tech company that helps law students study for the bar. We got about 4,000 students on the platform. I'm not currently raising capital for it, but I still have a pitch deck because it helps me rally my marketing team and whatnot. I have my own mentors because I'm so close to it that when I try to communicate it to an external party, you take for granted how much other people care or understand the things you're saying. And so just having that chance to run through your pitch and identify those deficiencies, it can make or break, getting that investment.
So let's talk about the pitch deck. That is the initial document that either you will upload in some kind of a deal flow platform, or you will send it to prospective investor via email. How does a good pitch deck should look like? What are the key elements that a founder must include in their pitch deck? What is the number of pages which are ideal? Today we understand, Sean, that people have less and less focus to give on any one page. So I have seen pitch deck which are 40 pages long, and then there are pitch deck which are 5 pages long. So what is the ideal? Should they have two pitch deck, one that they just send in an email, one pitch deck that they will be presenting with? What is the magic number? How does it work?
Good question. Good question. So the answer to the first question, should you have two decks? Absolutely. And the reason for that is like let's take a step back. So one of the biggest mistakes that entrepreneurs have or startup founders when they're pitching is failing to empathize with their audience and recognize that you don't get the audience that you want. You get the audience that you get. Like you don't, everyone hopes that the audience is going to be as interested and as focused and as just captivated by the thing that you're doing. 'Cause you love it. You're passionate about it. You're excited by it. And so you want them to, but investors are largely desensitized. Like they've been pitched on groundbreaking things every day, every week. Like that's their life. And so yes, like you still want to get them excited, but it takes a little bit more effort to get them to focus and read through or listen to you. And so first off, you want to have two decks. You want to have two decks. Why? Because they're not interchangeable. There's two types of decks. One is going to be a presentation style deck. That's one that has the benefit of you as a narrator. So that's one that you present in person. And because a presentation deck has the benefit of a narrator, because it has you to tell the story, the deck is usually lighter on details. Like the deck is a hype man. The deck re-emphasizes the bullet points or the main pieces of content that you want to make sure your audience takes in as they're listening to you talk. But people are generally good at listening or good at reading, but not at the same time. And so what happens that I see is that people have one deck and it's usually an email deck that's super wordy, super detailed. They try to pitch with that. And then the audience either doesn't bother to read it because they're listening to you, or they ignore you while they're reading the deck. So yeah, I always advise my clients, you're going to start with like two decks. Generally speaking, email decks usually come first, because the opportunity to present in person doesn't always come up, but the opportunity to email something to somebody does. So your email deck will be more detailed. You can include links to things, but it's still the same rules where you have to recognize that, you're going to get a couple minutes, a few minutes of an investor opening your deck, probably scrolling through it pretty quickly to see if it fits within their investor thesis, and then deciding if they want to spend more time before they go to the next thing. So you can't have a ton of slides. You can't have 40, 50 slides. How many slides should you have? I mean, it depends. If we're not counting your, appendix, then you're looking at like 15 to 20 slides. But it's less about the how many slides and more like how you structure it and how you communicate it. My recommendations always starting clearly with just what's the problem you're solving? People like to start with like a team slide, and my running joke on that is anyone who thinks that that is correct, I will fight you in the street. Because it's just, again, it's just not honest. We want to believe that the audience wants to get to know us, but they don't. If you're an investor and you're getting, 20 pitch decks a day that you're reviewing, I don't know if I want to know about the team until I care enough to know about the team. I want to know, is this the type of investment for me? Is it a problem I believe in? Is the market big enough? Like, once I know that I'm interested in maybe investing, then I want to know, do I trust the jockeys that are actually going to be riding this horse? When you put that team slide up front, it's just another barrier to, again, you have 3 minutes. You have 3 minutes tops to hook their attention span. And so you want to get them to know, what are we talking about? What's that pain you're solving? How are you going to solve it? How big's the market? And then from there, flow into, and again, I have a template that we share with your audience of different decks and things, or different slides that I'd recommend. But that's the flow. That's the flow that we've been able to prove through data, through the hundreds of companies that have gone through the programs I work with, which ones actually move the needle. Like, there is a methodology to accepting a critical audience and how they interpret new information, like an investment opportunity.
Right. Understood. Yeah, I exactly know what you're saying. I have seen over 2,000 deck in the last 2.5 years. We have a deal flow platform, and a lot
Sounds
of
about right.
people do apply there. Somebody who starts with the team or something else, really, those are the showstoppers. You need to talk about why you're a startup and where are you in your journey and how big the market is and how you're going to solve the problem that you are trying to tackle. How about some traction, Sean? Where the startup founder should include the traction, from the customer perspective, from some of the earlier fundraising that they have done, what is the ideal way and where it should be positioned?
So traction is amazing. Traction is something that I've reviewed many decks where, even if I don't quite understand the problem, even if I don't quite understand the solution, even if in the back of my head I'm thinking this is stupid, like nobody likes this. And then they get to the traction and they're like, we have $1 million, ARR or something. And that allows me to go, what do I know? Like, what do I know? Like, if someone's paying for it, if they have users, but usually that's going to be built in later on in the deck. Because again, there's a story component where we need to acclimate the audience to this new idea. If we jump in with traction, if you started off, I've seen people pitch where they start off talking about how they have 1 million users on their application. That's interesting, but what are they doing? Like, what? And as you start confusing the audience and making them wonder things, they distract themselves. Now, instead of listening to you, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, but what are they doing? Or I'm thinking, wow, that's impressive, but like, what are they working on? How did you get 1 million users? If you put it out of order, then it creates more questions and distraction than value. But if you have it later on the deck, when you've established what it is you do, who your market is, then the traction is a way for you to validate that your claims are true, that it is a real problem. It is something that the market cares about. How do I know? Because I have these numbers. And it's just a seamless transition into me just, okay, there's efficacy now. I can believe you. Let's move on. And just to add, efficacy is huge, because one of your biggest enemies in pitching to investors is the collective memory of investors. You might be the most honest person in the world, doesn't matter because people, like every investor has been lied to, every investor has been misled, every investor has been hyped to something that turns out to not be that. So they're coming at it from a critical perspective of I don't want to be lied to again. And so you got to do more than just hope that they trust you. You got to show them the data. You got to show them something more than just believe me, because they've fallen for that before and it didn't work out well.
Wow, sure, it makes sense. And now I can see that, why TAM, where are you in your journey, and then the traction. So now it flows through that the efficacy comes into the play, and then, you're not confusing the investor. What else? What else would you recommend a startup founder who is going to raise money should be the fifth, sixth, or the seventh slide in the pitch deck?
Man, so one of the two of the most important slides, and again, if we get past the problem statement and the solution statement, which are just, they're important, but they're kind of important, like you obviously they're important because without those, I don't even know what you do. But beyond that, the market sizing slide is huge. So knowing your TAM, SAM, and SOM, knowing your total available market, your serviceable available market, and serviceable ob obtainable market. Ugh, say that five times fast. But knowing your TAM, SAM, and SOM is important for two reasons. One, it will show the audience, it'll show the investor that this is actually investable. In fact, that's why we recommend that usually comes, it's going to be like slide three, slide four, like right after you get past the solution, basically, after I explain to you how I fix it, then I want to explain how big's the market. Why? Because it fits within that 3 minute window of attention span. And if we remember that your biggest enemy is the collective memory of investors, every investor, as well as being lied to before, they have all fallen in love with startups that later on just don't have an investable market. Like they'll fall in love with a new technology, and then towards the end of the slide, they get to the market sizing, and it's like a $20 million market or something. Okay, so it doesn't matter if I believe your problem. It doesn't matter if I believe your solution. It doesn't matter if I love your team. It doesn't matter if at the end of the day, the market isn't big enough for me to invest. And now I've just wasted my time. Like I've listened to this pitch that I could have been doing something else. And so by tucking that up quick, by establishing early on that this is a big enough market for us to actually make money, that's what carries them on to like, okay, I gave you 3 minutes, I'll give you 10 more to try to prove to me that this is worth investing. So that's important. So the TAM, SAM, SOM establishes that. The other thing that a TAM, SAM, SOM does is it helps you establish confidence of your own market. Like if you the founders who can clearly articulate those types of numbers, who know the size of their universe, who know the lowest hanging fruits that make up the 5 years that they're going to attack first of that market. Like when you have the ability to articulate that, the amount of confidence that that conveys to a room full of investors is like, wow, this person knows their market. And that's what they want. Like investors, if someone invests in you and you run into some problem, it's like 3 a.m. and you're in some problem and like the company is gonna, be on fire. Investors, they'll pick up the call because they want to protect their investment. They want to be helpful. But investors prefer investments that all you need is their money. It's like you have the whole plan, you know what you need to do. You just need gas in the tank in order to execute on that plan. That's what they love. They love where it's like, just take my money, turn it into more money. And a solid market sizing or solid understanding of your market goes a long way to forgive maybe other discrepancies or other deficiencies in your pitch. The second slide, so that's the first big one, is that TAM, SAM, SOM is going to be your competitive matrix. The ability to acknowledge that you have competitors, the ability to clearly articulate what is different about you or what is better about you. It's important for, again, two reasons. One, most people in the audience probably have no idea who your competitors are. And so, yeah, you need to bring them up to speed. The worst thing you could ever do is try to pretend like you don't have competitors. I see that all the time. It's terrible because, generally speaking, a market without competitors isn't a market. Like, we are an efficient, globalized economy. And generally speaking, there's always someone else out there that is satisfying your market needs. And I want to know about them. Even if you are drastically different. That my favorite example is If you were legitimately the first mousetrap, if you were legitimately the first person to ever come up with the idea of a piece of wood and a spring and you put some cheese on there, you could technically say, like, I don't have competitors. I'm the first one. But again, if that's true, now we need to educate the market on why do they need a mousetrap. So you're going to burn a ton of money trying to explain that to them. But if we look at, like, how is the pain currently being solved? You do have a competitor, which is a house cat. Like, if you look at the problem as too many rodents, your market knows they have a problem. Your market is basically buying organic mice, mouse traps to catch them. And now that we've identified a competitor, I can explain why I'm better. I'm cheaper. You don't have to feed me. I can catch multiple mice. Like, that clarity in a competitive matrix, one, it goes back to that confidence. It lets me know that you know your market, you know the other players. But the other thing is it helps to articulate in words that I can convey later as when I'm trying to convince myself to invest in you. Because no one ever gets an investment at the end of the pitch. What happens is you communicate an idea to me, you communicate a successful story to your audience. They internalize that story to some degree. Then they go home, they talk to their loved one, they talk to their spouse, they go golfing with a friend, and they say, I just saw this really cool technology and it does this. And it's their ability to articulate what it is that they do and explain why it's better than the competition that gets them to then call you up and then cut you a check. So yeah, the competitive matrix, it sometimes it comes off as you're like, oh, just another slide. But if you nail it, if you actually nail it, it contains inside of it like that confidence of what you're doing and also helps you to turn your audience into advocates for what you're doing so that they can argue with somebody when they're like, oh, I've heard of that. No. That one is terrible. The one I saw is better for these reasons. Like, you're arming them with that language. So super important.
Sure. What is the role of the advisor in a pitch deck?
So, good question. So, if you have advisors, and if you don't have advisors, go get them. Like, you're not, and because a lot, I would say, at least more than half, 60% of the decks I see don't have advisors. And maybe they do, but they don't include them. But so to answer your question, they go to help fill in some of the deficiencies that an investor might be worrying about. Because the ultimate goal of a pitch is to accept that your audience is coming to you critically looking to talk themselves out of giving you money. So they have all these red flags in their head. The purpose of your pitch is to diffuse as many of those red flags as you can. You'll never get all of them, but again, we're trying to be strategic. And so your team slide assures me, the investor, that you have the right people to actually make this work. But if you have some deficiency in, I see a lot of biotech companies with young founders. Okay, again, you graduated top of your class from Harvard. You have a background in biotech. You're like, okay, that's neat. But you're 23. Well, and so like, do you know? But then you have this advisory board of experience of like people who have gone beyond theory to actually have hands-on understanding of the market or the problem. Or so the advisor slide for me, it goes to help me figure out, are we going to plug some of those deficiencies? Because again, I don't want you calling me at 3 a.m. asking me for some help to keep your company imploding. I want to know you have a support network of other people that believe. And then just knowing that it also kind of helps with your go-to-market strategy. If I look at your advisors and I see they so happen to have overlap with your market, that's great. Because now I know that when we get your funding, you have connections into those places that you need to sell. So it's also kind of a reduced, cost strategy in your deployment of your technology.
Great. And I think, if the advisor is also a small investor in your company, that solidifies the concept and the problem that you are trying to solve also. So
100%. If you have that, that's icing on the cake. Like, if you have people that have trusted you enough to give you money and join to give advice, that's a great thing to, again, convey in your deck. Let the audience know that that's the case, because that'll go a long way.
right. I have a question on the TAM, SAM, and SOM, more so on TAM. I have seen pitch deck where the total addressable market is $20 million. Obviously, it is not a big enough market. How do you react to when somebody says the total addressable market is $10 billion or $100 billion? and I'm just looking for 10% of that.
Okay. I love your questions because it's I do a workshop on this, and these are common things that people get hung up on. So first off, let's talk about the size of the TAM. The TAM should ideally be in the billions if you can swing it, because like, what is the TAM? The total available market is an imaginary, unachievable number that sole purpose is to draw a line in the sand and say, if everyone who could buy my thing did buy it, this is how many dollars is it that it's worth. Apple will never achieve its TAM. Google will never achieve its TAM. No company will ever achieve the full potential. Why? Because no one ever has 100% of their market. And so then the question is, well, then again, why do I care? Because if you do the math on it, and it does come to like $20 million. If I do the math and I say, like, if everyone bought my thing, it's worth $20 million per year, and I know that I will never have 100% of the market, I don't need to think anymore to be like, okay, this isn't big enough for me to get into. It's not like you haven't passed the threshold to know. Because again, I don't have to, it's not to say I don't believe in your product. It's just not investable. Maybe it's a nice lifestyle brand, because again, you're not going to hit 100%. But when you start touching the billions, you don't want to, definitely there's a line, because when you start getting to the 100 billion or a trillion, now I'm starting to wonder, are you being honest with how you define who's actually going to be using your product? Let me give you an example from a client I'm working with right now. They defined, it's a clean tech technology. Their technology will enable energy producers to reduce the cost of like generating wattage at their plants, is the best way I can put it. So their technology makes it more efficient, and then that reduces their cost so they can create more margin on the power they generate. Their TAM, they originally included, was the value of the energy they provide. So they're like, the market is a $200 billion market, because $200 billion of energy is produced. But that doesn't make sense to, like, they don't get a piece of that. It's not like their technology gets 1% of the savings. That's not their business. Their business model is, I sell you something for X dollars, which means that their TAM is actually, if their device costs $1,000, it's $1,000 times how many energy producers are there, which drastically reduced their TAM to something that now I'm working with them to see how we can strategize around that. So anyway, long story short, the number, that's kind of where we come in. That if it's too low, it's immediately, I'm going to write you off because it's just not worth even finding out more. If it's too high, then it can be a red flag as you don't actually understand your market. But the other thing you mentioned is, and I see this all the time as well, they say it's a $100 billion market, and if I only get 1% of that, then we're all going to be driving Lamborghinis. It's kind of how they pitch it. That's what's called a top down analysis. So if you're trying to calculate your market size, a top down analysis is the lazy approach of, like, it's this big, and if I just get, this percentage, then whatever. What we're trying to do is a bottoms up. We're trying to build up the number. So that's why it's important to have your TAM, SAM, and your SOM, because your TAM is that limit of your universe. But your little circle, your SOM, your serviceable obtainable, is sort of like, what can you actually attack in your first 5 years? Like, what are you going to actually go after, the lowest hanging fruit? It allows me to get a feel for, is it realistic? Like, is it realistic for you to get 1% or a half? Like, do you have a strategy? It's not good enough for you to just say, if we get 1%, I want to know, do you have a plan to get that 1%? And if I could just, like, real quick, especially if people are listening and try to follow along, I can use my own company as an example. So again, I have an ed tech company, and I help law students study for the bar exam. My TAM is the amount of law students that exist at any given point. And there's about 100,000 law students at any given point during the year. I sell my app for $40 per month. So my TAM, if you do the numbers on it, my TAM is about $36 million per year. I cannot earn a dollar more than that unless there's more law students or I increase the cost of my app. But again, so that's the size of my universe. The next thing I want to do is look at like who am I going to go after first? That's going to be people in my backyard. We got like 18 law schools within driving distance. So I'm not going to go fly to New York and try to sell to those law schools when I can drive down the street. But as I start building the story, we start to see like, oh, I know how I could get a percent of that TAM, not just because I want it, but because I have a strategy on how I would go to market, deploy, and get there.
Right. So true, so true. And that is the way it should be. And the example that you gave about your ed tech company for law students, it makes sense that hey, try to achieve what is local and then start going up. And on the pricing also, yeah, you can make more revenue by increasing the price, but then everybody is not out there to buy app for $90 a month, Maybe $39.99 is that key number that people are accustomed to in today's economy, and they will go for it. So I completely understand that. You are also a mentor and an advisor with TechStars for the last 1.5 years. Tell us some stories from there. What do you mentor on, and what type of companies you are looking at over there? TechStars is a big name, and Y Combinator, TechStar, all these guys. So, what is happening there? What is next big thing which is coming out?
Oh man. So I help with two cohorts at TechStars. So I work with their general tech cohort, which has a lot of SaaS-based apps, and even one of the coolest ones was it's a startup. It has like a space foundry. So it's the idea is if you're going to create something like fiber optic cable and you do that here terrestrially on planet Earth. Despite how advanced we are, there's still limitations just by having gravity that it affects the quality of those fibers. And so this company has figured out that like if we launch raw material into low Earth orbit, and then we have these manufacturing facilities in basically satellite factories in space, we can create things like fiber optic cables that are more pure and have like I forget if it's like 10x, but it's some huge multiplier of efficiency. They can have more data transfer rates and all that other fun stuff just by having it being manufactured in a low gravity type of place. And then they take it and their technology delivers it back safely to Earth. And that was wild to me. Like to think that we're in the future now where we're going to have little like S Star Wars
Yeah.
robot manufacturing plants that are circling us in orbit. That was pretty cool. I also saw some cool technology where it was like creating smart concrete, and that was fascinating to me because it warped my understanding of physics. The idea was the founder had come up with a way to make a sort of laminated molecule, and you add it as like a powder to your cement. And what happens is when that molecule is put under strain, it reflects signals back differently based on how much strain it's under. And so the idea is you can build a bridge with concrete and this additive, and then you go up to the bridge with what's effectively like a large stethoscope. You send a signal, you vibrate into the concrete at a certain frequency. It reflects back a signal, and based on that signal, you can know like the health of the bridge. You can know if there's a failure point developing. You can know if
Yeah.
there's a stress fracture, something like that. Requires no batteries. Require it's like it just it's this passive, safety mechanism that lasts as long as the bridge. Yeah, Techstars. What I love about Techstars is they attract a wide audience and really get to pick some of these, cream of the crop type tech that I have fun just learning about. Like I have fun changing my understanding of the world. And what do I do there? My focus there is again helping them to create that story. As we mentioned before, my tagline is, basically be get understood, be funded is the my policy, because people don't realize that like that's the most important asset you can own is people like caring about what you're talking about. If you can't grab someone's attention and resonate with them, I have seen amazing technologies die on the vine, like cancer therapies, clean tech, energy. I've seen things that to me, I still think about, I talk to my friends about, and now they're dead because they couldn't raise capital because they just couldn't get anybody else excited. And then I see other things like new dating apps and stuff, and they raise $1 billion because the founder's able to, yeah, get people excited. Like the story is everything. So that's why I work with them a lot there. And then just early commercialization needs, marketing strategies, helping them understand and build out a TAM, SAM, SOM, any of those core components of the deck. But yeah, TechStars is wonderful.
Very, very nice. Two more questions. One is be understood and get funded. What are the five do's and five don'ts
Oh
when
man.
somebody is pitching to an angel group or to an angel investor individually?
Five
And
do's.
I'll give you one. I hate people when they are reading from the pitch deck. Number one.
Oh,
Number
yep.
two, I hate people when the pitch deck is out there, I'm reading it, and then they are looking somewhere, they are not making the eye contact, and they are just reading it from some other notebook that they have written that what to say. It looks so immature that if you can't convey your story about your product, whatever you are building, in a common language, and you are using the other day I was on a pitching event and people were using a lot of acronyms. And we are not expert in every area. So, to understand an acronym becomes so much more difficult. So, Sean, as a be understood and get funded, authority, what are the five do's and five don'ts when somebody is pitching to an angel group?
All right. So let me pick up on the two that you mentioned, because 100%, because just to be transparent with the audience, yeah, I don't have like off the t I don't have a written list on these, but I love thinking through. So let's start with what you talked about. I love the fact that your feedback recognizes that you are a participant of the audience. Like you go into these events as an investor, as someone who is probably kind of wanting to be entertained. Like you're not, you have better things to do with your time than go to some boring lecture about some new tech. So you want to be engaged. And a lot of times the founders don't know that. Their body language, they're not even excited about their tech. So the one of the mistakes, as you pointed out, is that they're so focused on reading from a script. In their head, they're like, the way I get money is I can't deviate from the script that I have focused so much time on. And though it's good to be precise with language, it's like they're giving up all these other factors that will help them get investment, like the interpersonal skills of being a suave CEO that you as an investor can be like, yeah, I could see that person raising more money. I could see that person leading a company. I can believe in that person as being a leader. So body language is huge. Tribal language is a huge one. You mentioned with all the acronyms, one of the biggest mistakes is that, and this goes back to empathy. They don't take a moment to appreciate and put themselves in the shoes of their audience that they don't know what all of these various acronyms mean. That's why when I was talking to you, and I go through the effort of like TAM, SAM, SOM is total available markets. Like even though when I'm talking to all my buddies, we just say TAM, SAM, SOM. The ability to recognize that someone in the audience doesn't know what this means. And so that's a moment for you to unpack it because you want them to give you money. No one's going to give you money if they don't understand what it is you're talking about. So tribal language is huge. Another common one, not it's not as common, but it's a big mistake. More than one person pitching. That is a huge mistake. It should always be one person pitching. I have literally only seen one pitch successfully raise money that had more than one person pitching. It was three co-founders, and it was this crypto investment company, and it was flawless. I don't know how much they rehearsed it, but they flowed in like it was just this show. I asked for a recording of it when it was done because it was just such a wonderful view of like how well three people could flow into each other and complement each other. With the exception of that one, out of the thousands of pitches I've seen, what usually happens is they stumble over each other and nobody knows when to talk or they just they get conf it has more questions to the audience because it kind of one will say something that isn't right and the other will correct them. So they go into it. Sometimes they do this because as co-founders, they don't know who should be the voice. It's like picking a lead singer in a band. Yes, whoever pitches is going to get acknowledged as being kind of the leader, even if there's more than one leader. So yeah, so they go in with multiple people, they try to do multiple people. The end result is it's a less efficient use of time. And that's what a pitch is. A pitch is a time budget, and having two people talk is just less effective than having one person. Another common issue, live demos or videos. It's common for people to include in their deck a video. And so you're up there pitching, you're connecting with your audience, you're building rapport, you're building momentum, like you're getting everybody, like they're feeding off the energy. And then you kill that momentum by saying, let's watch a video. And then you play a video, and usually like the audio doesn't work at first. And so you got to stop. And so, but even if there's not technical difficulties, the video, it's less effective use of that time than if you would have told me that same information. If anything, sometimes if you have a visual, have it playing behind you as you talk, but to stop that momentum, to go and risk that it's not going to work. So to include risk in your pitch, to play a video, so I can listen to a recording of you talk over it, just kills the flow of it. So man, it's easy to come up with the things that are like the things that I'm like, don't do. The things I would say to do, one would be, it's okay to be excited. Like it's okay to give up the veil of I'm trying to be the straight professional engineer. That, again, I'm not saying be silly and do balloon animals up there, but to, people can tell by the tone of your voice, is this something that you are actually interested in? And that goes a long way for investors, because there's easier ways to make a living than starting a company. Like starting a company is, it is a lot of work. You were going to have multiple nights where, yeah, you're up at 3 a.m. questioning your life choices. And the thing that keeps you going is that passion. And the thing that helps an investor know that you're not going to bail out on them and call it quits after you already spent their money is knowing that you are so obsessed with solving this problem. You are so passionate about solving this problem that the money is a means to accomplish your obsession, which is solving that problem. And the people that get up there and are just kind of tone deaf, like they don't appreciate the value, I guess, of conveying that excitement. So yes, be excited. It's okay to let the audience know that this is a passion of yours. What else? What else is a definitely a do? Another do. Oh man.
I think I like when people know their numbers. But they know their revenue numbers, they know their cost, they know how much they spend on marketing, what is their payroll, all those numbers are quarter on quarter numbers. Because I have seen in the Q&A, if investor is interested, they will ask grilling them, okay, how much percentage did you grow quarter over quarter? And they say, okay, let me check, or I'm not ready with that, becomes a no show. Because as a founder, how could you not know your numbers?
100%. I love that. I took that one for granted, but I agree with you 100%. You need to be prepared. And shockingly, a lot of people, when they do pitch, yeah, you ask them a simple number, like what, what's your cost of goods? And they're like, oh, I think it's this, or it might be this. And that is a lack of confidence, which goes against your, the ability of the audience to perceive you as being confident. The number one do, the number, and this kind of goes back to mindset, one that I encourage my teams about, especially if they're first time founders, is to recognize that the level of confidence you need to achieve when you pitch is to recognize that it is an equal exchange between you and the investor. And what I mean by that is I see a lot of founders who go and pitch for, like, they're asking for $1 million, $5 million. $5 million is a lot of money. Any of us would be happy, beyond happy, if a big bag of money fell with $5 million and was just out. Like, that's a lot of money. But when you get to the point where you have a solid pitch, and I'm thinking of, I won't name her, but I'm thinking of a specific founder who she had an amazing pitch and everyone in the audience loved it. It was going great. And then she got to the ask And when she asked for the money, she literally choked up. She was like, today I'm asking for 5 million. Like, she almost lost her voice. Like, she, and it just killed that momentum, because it was in that moment that you recognized she wasn't actually confident. She recognized that she needed the money more than she thought we valued the investment. And what I try to explain to my founders is yes, $5 million is a lot of money, but the room of investors, they could go out and invest their money into the stock market. They could go put it into bonds. They could go put it into, there's 1,000 other vehicles to invest money. The reason that they're in the room is because they have more money than they have opportunity. And you have more opportunity than you have money. And with that in mind, like, it's okay to just be like, I need 5 million bucks and you're welcome for me giving you this opportunity. Like, you don't actually say that, but that level of confidence to be like, I am trading you an opportunity to have a multiple on your money that you will not have anywhere else. That level of confidence goes a long way with investors, and having that mentality that your early stage company, if you truly believe in it, if you truly believe in your numbers, is an equal exchange for that cash in your pocket. That can carry, that can get investors to be like, let's do it. Like, I believe that this jockey can carry us across the finish line.
Sure. I like that. And, you know, I was just pondering upon all the points that you made, you know, from two or three founders or co-founders pitching at the same time, one after the other. That for me is also a complete, they shouldn't be doing it, because, you know, you changes the energy level. One guy is here in his pitch, in his language, everything. The other guy comes, either he is here or she is here. Doesn't work that well at all.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. It breaks the momentum altogether, you know. Yeah. Now, let me ask you one more thing. You know, how about the icebreakers? You're doing a Zoom presentation with a bunch of investors, or you are at one event, like, you know, we do a quarterly event called the Startup Game Changer. There are 12 curated companies. They come, the room is full with about 100 investors from 75 plus angel groups of Orange County, San Diego, and LA County. How do you connect with them? What should be the opening statement? Should they say something? What is the icebreaker? What do you like? What do you don't like, Sean?
Oh man. Okay. So this is an area that I am uniquely obsessed with. The term at least that I'm familiar with, it is called an opening gambit. And I believe it borrows from chess. And so it's like, well, yeah, what's your first move going to be? And this is difficult. Like, let me warn the audience that opening gambits are something that are entirely dependent on timing, on tone. Like, if two people attempt the same icebreaker, that same first move, one could succeed and one can fail just based on how they do it. And so let me give you an example of two opening gambits that I've seen that were really resonated with the audience. So the first one was a founder, gosh, this was years ago at like a Tech Coast Angels black tie event. And I remember this founder, when I first saw him, I went to the restroom basically just to like freshen up. So I'm like washing my hands, like doing my hair, whatever. And when I went in, there's this guy behind me doing like audible, like la 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 la, like he's doing voice. Okay. And I had no idea what he was doing, what or anything. I was thinking, this guy's kind of weird. I'm gonna get out of here. So I remember I get out of there and I was telling my wife about it. I'm like, there's this guy that's doing these voice warm ups. Next thing I know, he's like the second person to pitch. And when he came out, he does this loud, like this loud scream, like, oh, I want to plan. He was going into his problem statement. I could never pull that off. Like, even like, I cringe even attempting to do that right now for the podcast listeners, but he nailed it. Like, what we found out later is he's like this Disney Nickelodeon kid. So he has like professional acting training, but he just came into a quiet stage and got everyone's attention by basically pretending to be the customer at first about identifying the problem in the statement. So his opening gambit was this emotional, like, it wasn't saying anything. It wasn't telling anything. It was just connecting with the audience by catching them off guard, but doing it in a way that intrigued everyone to be quiet, focused, try to figure out what was going on. he raised a ton of money. Like this guy, he never got the company off the ground from what I know, but I think he raised like a few hundred thousand dollars just by being so effective in his pitching. The second example, Opening Gambit was, it was a biotech company, and it was trying to help people when it came to a certain type of like heart condition. And his opening gambit was, he recognized that his audience was a bunch of like older men who fell within his demographic, and he just flat out said, what percentage of them in the audience are likely going to die if they don't have his technology, which caught everybody. Everybody was listening then. Like, and again, I don't remember the exact wording, but he basically just said, like, I'm looking out at my audience today, and though I'm like so happy to see you today and I appreciate your time, unfortunately, my pitch today is going to be about how a quarter of you in this audience are going to possibly die within the next amount of years unless this problem is addressed. Everyone's paying attention now. So opening gambits, yeah, it's like it's finding that one thing about your tech or you personally that you can exploit to catch people and their attention. Now, the reason it's called an opening gambit is because if you screw it up, you can completely lose their trust and their attention span. But if you do it right, if you find that one thing, that factoid to connect with them, maybe it's the time of day. I saw someone connect once with just it was the weather. I mean, even something like that, like just pointing out the freakish weather that they were having outside. And then they found a way to tie it into their technology, which was a type of clean tech. That it shows that it's not scripted. It shows that even though I know that you practiced for hours to say the words that you're saying today, I know that I'm talking to a human being. Like there's some charisma there. There's some ability and self-awareness to tie and customize what you're going to tell me today to sort of what we're talking about today. So icebreakers, that's what I would go for. You look for a way to sincerely address your audience in a way that makes them feel like you actually see them. Like you're not just some talking robot up there repeating the same pitch that you always do. And it goes a long way. It goes a long way.
I'll give you two examples, and I would like to get your feedback. I was there at the Unwind Tech Week last year. We are going to participate this year also, and we will be doing the community event there. There was a guy, we had organized a pitching event as the community event with the help of Sunstone. And there were two people who wanted to make some changes to their pitch deck at the last moment, and which could not happen because they were trying to upload, and the internet was not working fine, and whatnot. And in the statement, they said that they started going through their pitch deck, and then they said, "Okay, oh, this is not my most current pitch deck." And that was, to me and to many of the audience, was a complete showstopper. That hey, irrespective of you created this pitch deck, yeah, this is version 5.0. Now you are at 7.0, whatever. But how could you just completely disown your own startup or your own pitch deck?
Yeah,
So
100%.
yeah, so that was very funny. Why would you do that? You are in room full of investors. So to the audience, I would say, even though you're not using your most current pitch deck, don't ever say that, "Well, I'm not prepared because as soon as you start trying to find excuses, it doesn't sit very well with the audience. What is your comment on that, Sean?
I never negotiate against yourself. Like, I mean, that's just at the end of the day, my background is as a graphic designer. One of the funny things about being a graphic designer is I can create something for a client and they love it. People love it. Like everyone that I see it, it gets a positive response. But all I can see is those three pixels that I didn't do correctly that drive me crazy because I'm so close to it, and it would be silly for me to give it to the client and be like, here you go, sorry about those 4 pixels that I screwed up, because they don't see it. But some people have this feeling that that it does a it's like honest or something to call it out to tell people your insecurity when no one wants to go to the doctor and before a surgery and they're like I'm pretty confident this is going to go well, you know. I'm decent. I didn't have a good morning. I have a little kink in my neck, but you'll probably be okay. Like no, you want that confidence of like it'll be everything's going to be fine. Give me yeah. Don't negotiate against yourself. I 100%.
I'll ask you one more question and then we will close the podcast. How do you react to some funny line as the opening statement? For example, how many of you went to a strip club last night?
So something like that would depend on the audience. I'm trying to think like ultimately the goal of an opening gambit is it has to tie, there has to be some logical connection to something that is relevant to what they're doing. So I can't think of where something like that would be relevant. But if you could, like let's say that your product had to do with hygiene, like you had a product that had to be like UV cleaning or something like that, maybe. Let me give you a personal example. A few months ago, so before the holidays, I was invited to present down at this investor club to it's like a the forgetting the name of it, but it's like a nationwide wealthy investor type group that moves the meeting around. It so happened to be local, so they invited me to come tell them about what we're working with in the community in SoCal, this or that. So room of like 30 people, very high net wealth, very, and doctors and very high professionals. And they had me go on right before lunch was my time. And we were running late. So all the other pitches. So I'm already knowing that people, nobody wants to be me in that position. I'm the last thing separating them from lunch. But I picked up on as they were the two people that had pitched before us, no, the three people that had gone before me. One was like a law firm. And so before their pitch, they put up a big disclaimer. And then the second one was like an investment firm. So they put up a disclaimer. And so by the third one, I forget the third one was like a medical company. They put up a disclaimer. Everyone's starting to laugh at the disclaimer. The third one, the person pitched on how they're using like medical tech and AI to develop things, blah, blah, blah. And so you know what? I was like, I have an idea. I think I know. So I opened up my slideshow. And I went to ChatGPT and I told ChatGPT to create me a disclaimer based on like certain parameters or whatnot. And so then before I went to go pitch, I like my first slide was a disclaimer. And I was like, before I get started on this, I want to throw out my disclaimer. And everyone at first is like, oh my God, like here's another one. And then I just told him, I said, no, I'm just joking. Like before, I said everyone else was doing it, so I want to do it. So I had ChatGPT create this for me. And I said, I don't even know what it says. And so we kind of read through it and all the weird things that so the audience was just cracking up, laughing. And I addressed the elephant in the room. I'm like, I'm glad I got you. I said that bit of dopamine that I want you to hold on to that because we're gonna get through lunch. Cause I know I'm the only thing that's separating you from a meal right now. It worked. I got a ton of business from it. I got a ton of introductions and a lot of cards. I think I got more engagement than had I just went with my stock, like, hi everybody, I'm from this, please listen to this. So jokes can work or like humor can work, but the delivery is everything. Like at the end of the day, it falls on your ability to do it. But the way I look at it is take a risk. I've done opening gambits that have failed and embarrassed me. And I learn from them. And there's always another pitch. There's always another pitch. There's always another presentation. It is better for you to take a risk and learn from it than to keep pitching the same stale, unpersonable type of communication that you've been trying. But anyway, so yeah, I'm a big fan of humor in that. If you can connect it.
Sounds good so much. Thanks, Sean. So, that gives me an idea that we should be doing a AMA series or an AMA based podcast with live audience, asking them to come up with an opening statement, and then you guiding them that how it should be done, and we will call it the opening gambit.
Love
For
it.
the AMA topic, so I will reach out to you. We will set up a time, and then we will market it so that we have live audience, and I think that would be a fun
That would be fun.
to so we will certainly do that. Obviously, I have invited you for the February 20th event, And you know, I'll be meeting with you in one of these local events which will be happening in Orange County and you know LA County. So thank you so much, Sean, for coming on my podcast, Startup Pulse. I hope you enjoyed it. And with your closing statement, tell people that you know I started founder how they can reach out to you if they are looking for help with the SBIR, with some legal stuff, or even what you do best, which is the be understood and get funded, how they should reach out to you and what is your engagement model for the
Yeah,
startup
absolutely.
founders.
So I recommend you going to my website, which is venturecraft.io. That will give you kind of an overview, some templates, things that we talked about on the show today will be there. Connect with me on LinkedIn. That's probably the best way to get in touch with me. The biggest way to get in touch with me is just get in touch with me. It's weird when usually I open up the line of communication with different audiences, like please reach out, and like two people do. And I really like when, if you want to talk with me, if you have any questions, please reach out through LinkedIn, send me an email. As for engagement with VentureCraft, usually it just starts with a meeting, figuring out what you're working on. What's fun about sort of my position in the groups that I work with is there are certain people that I engage with where it's they have the funding and the ability and the momentum to basically just have me and my team take over. You know, basically delivering a Disney quality TED Talk presentation that, you know, is going to raise some capital. You have other people that are a bit earlier stage, don't have resources, but we can connect you in with, you know, like Launchpad or SBDC groups or different grant funded operations where you'll be able to still get assistance even though you don't have capital at the moment. So first step is just reach out, let me know what you're working on, and then we'll figure out where, you know, where me or someone I know can add some value.
Sure. And in the description of this podcast, we will put your contact details. Including
Yes,
your
please.
LinkedIn and email ID. So with that, thank you so much, Sean, for coming and you know on my podcast, Startup
Thank
Pulse, and
you.
all the best, and see you soon.
Absolutely. And again, really appreciate you having me on here. This was really fun and looking forward to chatting again.
Yeah, take care. Bye-bye.
Take care, everybody.